folks, to episode 26 of the Running Man Self-Regulation Skills and Self-Improvement Project podcast with your host, me, Dr. Armando Dominguez, PhD in health psychology, licensed professional counselor, and an adjunct professor at a local community college. And what we're going to be discussing today is going to be something that hinges on learning, vicarious observational learning. Now, Albert Bandura did a lot of research during the 60s, early 70s, that really got this into the human potential movement, to where we started realizing not only aspects of learning, but also how we went about observationally picking stuff up without necessarily gaining a formal instructor, such as when we learn how to do something by watching someone when we're little. And even such things as if you see an adult or a person smoking, for instance, picking up a cigarette, you go and see a child maybe pick up a stick or a pencil or a crayon and do a similar action. This is vicarious learning at its best, in quotes. And I say that with a bit of a smirk because I've seen this happen. And I remember doing things as a child and being corrected that were similar to this and being chastised for it because I wasn't supposed to be doing that. Of course, now I understand why, but the important part is that there's some neurological structures that are very well involved with what we call observational learning, and we're going to be discussing mirror neurons because they play a huge role in, one, socializing as much as learning skills, too, and the mirror neurons are also very closely tied to motor neurons that activate and fire whenever we're learning physical movement or actually mimicking motion, so they're very closely aligned whenever we are learning by observation. So to kick this off, we're going to talk about the mirror neuronal structures. Now, I did remember the story that I told in the earlier episode. I'm not sure now even which one it is, but about the baby that dad was recording him, and minutes out of mom's womb, he was holding baby close and sticking tongue out, and baby was actually responding back to him. This is something that would fall within that realm of mirror neuronal or vicarious observational learning. Even though they say that babies cannot see very well, that's true. But at the very least, even though not clearly, they can at least see to a large degree with some clarity that they can differentiate shapes and facial structures, this sort of stuff. And if we think about even blindness that has occurred in somebody that has had sight before an injury to the back of the head, they may still maintain what is called blind sight. These are the deeper neuronal structures that run subconsciously, that you could be looking at a screen. And Dr. Ramachandran actually did some studies with this where someone could identify where motion was occurring. And they could point at it, but they couldn't tell you consciously what it is. They just knew that something was moving over there, and they would point a finger at it. And they were able to replicate that on a computer screen. So our brain and our capacity to perceive environment, even whenever we've had our conscious level of seeing damage, we're able to utilize that and pick up peripheral and even frontal motion at a subconscious level. So some pretty profound gifts that we have whenever we're fully sighted, first off, and even whenever we've been damaged. So why is the social learning, the vicarious observational learning, so important? Well, one of the things is that if we're going to learn how to become like or similar to, let's say, a tribe that we belong to, and let's say they dress a certain way, only use certain colors of jerseys, for instance, let's say skins, when we're cave people. Or maybe there's certain behaviors that they do if they live by the river and they fish. And let's say only the women do certain jobs and only men do certain jobs. By observation and learning, by seeing, we will learn what people do, and we tend to follow along and do what they do. And that's how we pick up skills very much. Now, these things can take just a couple of times just looking at, but if something is particularly novel and is not really a highly skilled thing that they're doing, it can be picked up very quickly, like picking up a rock and, let's say, pounding out a piece of fruit or something like this. Not hard to do. Of course, over time, it'll get refined and get better, this sort of thing, with guidance from the elders and the family members that are older. So why is this important? Well, one is being a part of a tribe, for instance, or a family or a group or a clan requires that we know our place, one, but also know what our value is to the tribe. What do we bring to the tribal table, so to speak? If I'm young enough and agile enough, I may be able to climb trees where the elder can't get to and get fruit. And then we gain the wisdom of the elders by their appreciation, by tossing things down to them, this sort of thing. So there's a trade-off and there is a value. So there's an exchange of value. One is I can climb the tree and get the fruit. Two, you teach me what your wisdom brings and I become better and I evolve a little faster, hopefully, along the lines of become a better, more productive human being with fewer deficits if you have somebody that is mentoring you, so to speak. So in the mentor relationship, can that happen as a result of that? Sometimes. Sometimes it can happen, and it's not perfectly predictable, but this is merely a story I'm kind of telling you to illustrate the point. But also, in the more adult relationship aspect of vicarious learning, knowing what behaviors are acceptable or not acceptable, what will get you kicked out of the tribe, what will get you acceptance and approval from maybe a potential mate. If we remember that maybe 100,000 years ago, if we lived to be into our mid or late 20s, we were eld. We were old. By today's standards, very young. But by those standards back then, and considering the danger and the frequency of exposure to the elements and possible hunting accidents, among other things, or illnesses, we didn't last very long. So our most productive years were in our mid to late teens, when we're most fertile and productive, but also most capable of fending off and running and jumping and fighting with the least amount of risk for twisting an ankle, for instance. As we get older, that becomes much more prolific in our modern time. But whenever we're seeing value, social value, and being able to find a mate, there are certain behaviors that we have to observe. If we look globally, there are many socialized rituals that we do, wherever people do certain things and gather and then pick mates that are suitable. And by learning what is appropriate and acceptable, knowing what is not appropriate, not acceptable, it keeps us within that range where we're still considered part of the group. And that lessens our chance of being kicked out. It increases our chances of being taken care of and also assisted by those that are in the group with us. And vicarious learning, once again, observational learning, plays a big part in learning the social cues, the social mores, things that are appropriate and that we want to make sure that we don't cross those boundaries. And knowing what the group rules in particular are, and sometimes they can be very peculiar within a single group, within a certain vicinity, not unlike certain cultures from east to west coast in the United States, or even from Europe to the United States, some difference, even though we may dress similarly. There are certain cultural values and certain things that until you're immersed in the culture, you won't know. Little bitty things, like a broom, for instance, in Asia, turned bristles up, can be very, very insulting. But unless somebody knows by having lived there, you won't know. Little things like this. But those are observed and learned, and there is a lesson that we become skilled at not doing those things to increase in acceptance, this sort of thing. So our social value goes up when we do things that are pleasing to the group, when we do things that are pleasing and acceptable to those that we would live with and share food with and hunt with. And we're also developing a sense of endogenous trust. There's a communication that goes on, even though it's not verbal, but just by behaviors. Those will soothe us and tell us that things are as normal. Just like whenever a hunter walks into the woods, things are as normal in the woods until you step in, especially if you don't belong in the woods. Because what would have been chirping and chittering and buzzing and all the animal sounds that we would hear otherwise gets silent. So in that sense, there is a signal that is being given that we read body language level that even precedes any language spoken or message spoken, and sometimes It is just maybe even an expression that is enough to give the message. So once again, the importance of this is really high relative to our survival mode. Now, relative to anxiety, what we experience whenever we feel like we're not belonging or we don't belong to a group or that we've been shunned by a group, this is particularly difficult for women. It's hard on young men too whenever we're in middle school, junior high age, from about age 11 to 12 to about 16 to 18. And the influence can become very high, such that people get depressed, they get anxious, and start working really hard to try to get back into the accepted in-group, so to speak. And sometimes we see even people losing hope and giving up and committing suicide as a result of this pressure. That is, I don't belong, not counting whatever bullying, because now you're different. And these are things that if we take a look at social learning, somebody had done them before, and then it didn't automatically just originate with one person. They became this novel exemplar of bad behavior where we shun and bully people. These are things that we may have seen or experienced ourselves. Could have been at home, could have been at school, or whatever social area I may have been in. And if we take it back to a long time ago when we were much simpler creatures living in caves and out on the plain as hunter-gatherers, this kind of shunning was devastating. That means no longer am I an apex hunter with my group. Now it is just me and my lonely six, my six being my backside, and nobody's there to observe to see whether or not there's a tiger out there trying to eat me and sizing me up like the next bologna sandwich. So we gain some subtle things. We gain some influence. We gain acceptance. And when we're shunned, we lose some things. And one of those is safety. Yes, there is safety in numbers. The result of the numbers is that you have more eyes scanning that you can cue into the body language that determines how safe you are and how safe you feel. So these are very tangible things. But fast forward to today, and even though being kicked out of a social group won't result in your eventual death because you're out hunting by yourself, what it does do, it gives you that sense or the feeling that we have over eons had that ingrained into our genetics that we inherit. And therefore, we feel that sense of pressure, that sense of loss, that sense of, oh my God, I feel like I'm going to die. Or it feels close to it because I don't belong in the group or I've been shunned from the group somehow. And it is very closely tied to what we used to know did make us much more vulnerable and much more apt to be hurt or killed. So it is not an imagination, exaggeration type of thing that goes on whenever we hear of kids doing the most heinous things to each other. And the kids that respond start feeling like they're giving up, they get depressed and don't want to be here anymore, or that they act out violently sometimes or even commit suicide. Those feelings of shunning, they're just very sensitive to. And not every single person is particularly sensitive to it. It just depends. And it's not all character strength. There's definitely an endogenous component that we have inherited that certain groups, like family, for instance, may be the most influential. And if we feel like we're getting kicked out of a group, especially if we're particularly close-knit, it can be very painful and make us feel like we're letting not only our parents down, but everybody down in the community. And that becomes incessantly more heavy when you live in a community or a culture that is very culture heavy versus individual heavy, in the sense you're letting down the whole of the group and your country, your people, your town, your village in a collective sense versus just mom or dad. So that is a big idea, yes, but we have to consider what we talked about in the past too, and that's, well, how compelling is this? How does that weigh inside of me? That's a very important thing to consider because it's a huge influence. When we're discussing dying for honor, and when people would commit suicide whenever they had dishonored their families, this sort of thing, in feudal Japan, this is the kind of social influence that is very powerful, that was very belief-born to the point where people would willingly lay their lives down to be cut down to save the face or the idea of honor in the family. So these are some very powerful drivers that can be shaped like it was in feudal Japan. And I certainly love the culture of Japan, don't get me wrong. I've trained martial art for years and I've gained a great deal of positive from involving myself with the culture and the ethic. But just the idea and being able to see through the distortions, the social distortions that can come as a result of what we would call gaining social value and also gaining influence, social influence, where we can sway people's beliefs and ideas and actions by virtue of what we say and what we get them to believe. How compelling is my message and how much do they believe it? Now, we've discussed the mirror neuronal structures and how we're kind of going along and doing what others do. Very closely tied to this, I said the motor neurons are activated based on what it is that we're seeing so we can encourage our survivability. If monkey is washing a potato and then this little baby monkey sees them washing potato, then they have learned vicariously how to do that. They don't have to go back and learn from the first tater washing monkey to gain skill. They already know how. It's just a matter of doing it now and they gain the benefit. Not unlike what we do things, and sometimes we do so without question because it's the feeling of security and belongingness that may keep us attached to certain behaviors and certain responses. Now, I'd like to read something to you about mind, reactive mind, and being able to have a response, a mindful response with our mind, and the difference between the two. And it kind of illustrates why I believe very sincerely that self-regulatory skills start in the body, but also identifying what our body does to be able to guide it appropriately with practice is important. And knowing when we're in reactive state versus a responsive mindful state, once again, mindful being the media honey now for the last 10 years that has been lifted out of the older disciplines. Now, I'm pulling this out of the book, The Principles of Effortless Power, by a martial artist named Peter Ralston, and he is quite skilled, but also eloquent as a writer. But what I want to read here is a small portion of what a response is versus a reaction, and also what happens to us under stress that I've illustrated on and off throughout this podcast. And the paragraph starts this way. The functional mind. It is important to understand the difference between reaction and response. A response is born of calm mind and sensitive awareness. It is accurate and emerges from a state of equilibrium and balance. It is not blocked or forced and occurs spontaneously with no fear, desire, or consideration, but with great intelligence and attunement. What is needed and appropriate simply occurs. So there's no attachment, there is no judgment, and whenever we can do things with aplomb and in comfort, in a sense, without an emotional judgment involved, that allows us to move in a very balanced way, is what he's noting. Now, the difference in what happens when we're reacting is a bit different, and let me read that to you. A reaction, however, is the antithesis of a response, although both are involved in activity and relationship. A reaction is born of urges and tendencies and of unconsciousness, separative viewpoint, and unstable mind. It is oppressed by fears, desires, and considerations prior to and following its appearance. When it occurs, it is a blind thrashing of the unconscious tendency toward protection. Reaction is a contractive in nature. It is a withdrawal of sensitivity and relational awareness to act, often in a negative fashion in an attempt to solve or end, and in parentheses, destroy the apparent source of immediate danger or dilemma. So these are the points that we've been covering about how our body responds based on perceptions at a very high speed, at 150 to 300 milliseconds, wherever it's pre-verbal. It's all perceptual. Whereas we can still respond quickly, but without allowing our conscious mind to judge, we can respond more effectively in a more balanced way without allowing our emotions to cloud our judgment at the moment as to how we need to respond in a physical sense, like time to get out of here, or even engaging because somebody insulted my mom or my granny or something like this, and then doing the social emotional monkey dance where it's tit for tat. They say this and I say something back, and I start defaulting to the lowest level or the first strategy of the five strategies mentioned in episode 25, which is clashing. You strike me, I strike you. We both get hurt. Whoever hits harder wins. It's a very low-level strategic approach that certainly requires one to have more endurance than what your neighbor does, or else they win. And that's what it becomes. It becomes a win. That is about points on the board and saving your ego. It is not about baseline survivability of your human existence, which is what we're talking about and what we're trying to encourage, so that we can note the difference between what is dangerous and damaging to us potentially and those things that are just merely confabulations or conceptions that require us to believe, to get honked off and get excited about, and then respond reactively, and then have the facepalm and wish I could have that back moment after the fact. So these are preventative measures, and being able to be in a state of responsiveness, mindful responsiveness, will always be a superior to reactiveness in a general sense. Whenever it is full tilt boogie and we're in physical danger, reactive is helpful. I'm not saying it's bad. What I'm saying is that we're talking about self-regulation skills, not treating everything in our life as if it is life-death, to where our anxiety and our stress and our tension turns on to the point where it becomes self-defense mode, and everything is a high-strung, high heart rate reaction where I get tense and angry and upset, and I am incapable of being responsible or accountable for what I do. And then all I have left are the apologies and I'm sorries if it's done with someone that is a loved one or family members. And then there's embarrassment we have to deal with afterwards. So all of that can be avoided if we can provide a mindful response versus a reactive. That's where we're going to stop today. And I'm going to tell you thank you for listening. And this is actually a topic that's near and dear to my heart, because the training that I do requires that I press my body frequently, whether it be through weights, kettlebells, clubbells, get my heart rate up, and having my sons do knife and stick drills with me, so that way I have a sense of opponent but not enemy, and being able to do what I have to do without getting emotional and upset about it because they're trying to hit me. It conditions me to become better at a higher level, so that way I have a sense of control and I can read the environment more quickly without getting emotionally distraught, upset, or even shocked. And that's why I want to share this today, because this doesn't have to be a martial arts exercise, but it is one that we can walk every day and train by realizing the importance of how I view others tends to educate me, and sometimes I will do what they do. It also implies that much of what we learn is social camouflage. How can I get along to get along, to get the things that I need to live? That's not manipulation. That is learning how to survive, but also understanding the influence that observation has and how people can manipulate us by observational learning, by whatever actions they take, and by being mindful and to stay at third person or even second person, depending on the situation, distance in a situation that allows us to be more mindful in response and not feel manipulated or feel like we don't have a choice, and that we maintain that sense of I can get away from consequence and circumstance by catching it early. Early is best. Timing is everything. Like, follow, and share. And thank you again for your time. It's been a really good evening talking to y'all. Y'all take care. And if you have any comments or questions, please send to me your questions that you might have at runningmangetskills@gmail.com. runningmangetskillsproject@gmail.com. Y'all have a great evening. Take care. Walk along.